One of the things I love about public radio is that we learn something new every day. And today we will learn that we are not so smart. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, November the 3rd. While most of us think we are rational and logical, our guest says we really aren't. Our brains have a way of making us think that. So let's challenge our brains, let's think about thinking, and try to figure out if we can stop deluding ourselves. Maybe we'll be a little smarter after the hour is through. We welcome your questions for our guest, or you can tell him to go take a hike at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is David McRaney, a journalist and author of You Are Not So Smart, Why You Have Too Many Friends on Facebook, Why Your Memory is Mostly Fiction, and 46 Other Ways You're Deluding Yourself. He blogs at youarenotsosmart.com. Good morning, David. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, hey. Thanks so much for having me on here.
So do you have any friends, David?
being someone who is obsessed with this topic, I am the kind of person who... I'm at the party or I'm on the long trip and people are talking about something and I pipe up and go, what's actually happening there is blah, blah, blah. So over time, I have learned to keep my mouth shut if I want to have people help me move.
We'll get into many of us who are know-it-alls and talk a little bit about why that is. But how did you get obsessed with this?
I became obsessed with this. It was a multi-stage process. First things first is when my wife and I decided, you know, we needed to, if we didn't want to wait tables forever, we wanted to get a real education. And we were sort of doing sampling that. The class that just floored me was one of my first psychology classes. One of my first psychology professors, her name was Jean Edwards, and I tried to give her due credit in the book. She had one of these classes that just simply threw me for a loop. I had previously thought, like a lot of people, like maybe I'm the only person who's noticing some of this stuff. And she was like, "Oh no! There's 100 years of research that detailing how all these things work." And so I found the things that were the most epiphanous to me, the things that spun my head the most, were the ones that knocked me off my pedestal and made me realize that I was actually a deluded and irrational being, just struggling to make sense of things. And I thought, you know, that's probably true for all of us. And I thought I was pursuing a career in psychology over the next couple of years in college, but then I eventually switched over to journalism. But this blog was an opportunity to take my love of journalism and writing and smash it back into my love of psychology. And hopefully what I do over and over again on the blog and in the book is give people these similar epiphanies that I went through.
Well, give us an example of one of those epiphanies that knocked you off your pedestal.
Probably the glue that holds the entire thing together is something called confirmation bias.
Uh-huh.
And just cognitive biases in general. There's a whole wing of psychology that studies biases. Thomas Gilovich, he's a psychologist, he said the best thing that I think was ever said about biases as far as explaining them in shorthand. If you have, let's say, if you're right-handed and you have a preference for your right hand, then you are right-hand biased, and that means that in a situation where you could use either hand, you kind of tend to go with the right one. And a cognitive bias is if you have many, many options as to how you want to think or interpret a situation or come to a decision, we tend to have reliable cognitive biases that we prefer to think in certain ways instead of others. And one of those is confirmation bias. That is the tendency all human beings have to pay attention to information that confirms their beliefs. But you tend to ignore the information that challenges your preconceived notions. So that accounts for the magazines you subscribe to, the books that you buy, the television shows you watch, the news stations you believe are the ones that are trustworthy. It accounts for whenever you are debating an issue, whether or not you're going to believe what's coming from the other side. Because in an attempt to protect our self-esteem, we often pay attention to the information that just goes ahead and strengthens our the position we bring to the table, and we try to ignore things that may challenge us.
Well, I'm going to bring up a comment on Facebook right away since we're talking about the confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. One of our listeners, Jamie, writes, could the guest explain why confirmation bias and the filter bubble are part of the reason why Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio staff lay blame for any perception of the network's biases on the perceiver and fail to apply it to themselves? Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me. That's a little bit of a passive-aggressive backhand thing, but that's it's not inaccurate to say that every one of us has this confirmation bias. It's not something you can just delete. It's something you have to accept as part of who you are, and notice when you're using it in a way that is detrimental to yourself. So, I mean, the entire idea of science is really to get around confirmation bias. We had to create something, a scientific method, to avoid it. But when it comes to news, I hear that kind of criticism a lot, and I try to tell people to think of it like this. I know many people who say that Fox News or MSNBC, that these are networks that either are brainwashing their audience, or the people who are in the who work there are brainwashed themselves. Not so much the news coverage as it is the punditry, but that's really not the case. People don't get brainwashed by news organizations like that. They go to a organization like that because it's a safe haven. It's a place where they can be reasonably expect that their beliefs won't be challenged. And it's a pretty lucrative business to create safe havens. I think if you're going to criticize a news organization, you need to criticize them based on their accuracy. And but beyond that, I mean, everything is going to have at least a twinge of spin to it.
Well, another related comment on Facebook again, and we'll talk about why we have too many friends on Facebook in a minute. But Bonnie writes, 75% of us believed Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. That may be just ignorance of Middle East political reality, but it's stupid to be ignorant when there are so many sources of information available. Can you explain why so many people believe Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11 when apparently the facts say he was not?
Well, I mean, there are, there must be 20 things in the book that I could use to apply to this. First of all, the confirmation bias obviously plays into that. So if it's more about the desire that be true. There's something in psychology, everyone has probably heard of it, called cognitive dissonance theory. And cognitive dissonance theory is an umbrella that encompasses the fact that we tend to believe that our attitudes, that our behavior comes from pre-existing attitudes in our brain. But what we find is that attitudes tend to follow behavior. The desire, well, there's so much motivated thinking. Whenever you want something to be true, you will work toward the goal of making it so. And then when you look back on your path getting there, you'll use things like hindsight bias to assume that you used a rational, logical method to get to the end goal of believing a certain way. The beliefs that we have around whether it would be Saddam Hussein or any other political figure that have been painted in a negative light, they often arise through this attitude following behavior instead of behavior following attitude. And the crazy thing about the whole our attitudes surrounding 9/11 plays into something called hindsight bias, which is whenever we tend to look back on the way we feel, we tend to believe that we have always felt the way we do, going back a certain way. You know, no one would think they feel the same way they did when they were a teenager or a child. But when it comes to political issues, 9/11 actually was something that's been used in studies where they would have people fill out questionnaires about their current political attitudes, and then a couple years later ask them again, and people believe that they had been consistent that entire time, but the attitudes really do change.
So what's going on here? Why are our brains so untrustworthy?
Well, I try to say that the central theme of the book is that you're just unaware of how unaware you are. And I have found, I didn't realize this at first, but over time, I realized that I've been writing under the umbrella of a psychological, a wing of psychology called self-perception theory, which says that you're the unreliable narrator in your life. Because And when I say you, of course, I mean myself and everyone else. But you tend to explain your own thoughts, emotions, and actions as though you were explaining those of another person, but not just any other person. You are the greatest fan in the world of this person that you're talking about, and that's you. And that's because we are very highly motivated to maintain a beefy, beautiful self-esteem model. And whenever we go back and think about the things that we've done or the things that we've thought, we try to explain them to ourselves. The actual sources of those things are a lot, many times they're just completely inaccessible, but it doesn't feel that way. So we create a narrative, we create a story, and if you were to think back on your life or just your recent experiences as a movie, it's more like a movie that's based on a true story, and it's not a documentary. It's a entertaining, interesting, based on a true story, highly embellished narrative, and you are the beautiful, amazing protagonist in the center of all of that.
I have to. Is there any way that we can change this movie? any way to make our brains more reliable?
I think that critical thinking is important, and I think that for each thing I talk about in the book, I give a couple of caveats that say, I give a couple of ways out that say that, paying attention to this stuff is important, but it's less important to try to get around these things, to try to delete them from your life, because they may not be deletable. It's almost as if I'm saying, hey, have you ever noticed that you have a hand with five fingers on it?
Right.
I'm not suggesting that all of the wouldn't it be nice if we had seven hands? We create policies and we create goals and we engage in behaviors that we assume that we can get around these things. And I say that it's probably better if we just take these into account as natural stumbling blocks try to live a life that takes these into account instead of trying to falsely assume that we can get away with that we can get around them.
So realize what we're doing.
Realize what you're doing and predict that you're going to do it in the future, and then use that to create a strategy to outsmart your future self, who is going to be can be predictably unreliable.
We are talking about the many different ways that we are not so smart. Our guest is David McRaney. He is the author of this book, You Are Not So Smart, Why You Have Too Many Friends on Facebook, Why Your Memory is Mostly Fiction, and 46 Other Ways You're Deluding Yourself. We're talking about how our brain is contributing to deluding ourselves, and welcoming your questions, your experiences, your challenges, if you think you're so smart, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. As the G20 summit in France gets underway, Ben and his guest will discuss the European debt crisis, the surprise move in Greece, and what this all means for the global economy during At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 5 this afternoon. We are talking with the author of You Are Not So Smart. He also blogs at a website of the same name, youarenotsosmart.com. And we're talking about how our memory is mostly fiction, how our brain resists new ideas, and how we are constantly deluding ourselves. And we are welcoming your thoughts and questions for David McRaney. David, why do I have too many friends on Facebook?
It's one of those weird things that it's not that we can't keep up with a whole lot of names, maybe a thousands of names and people that we've met. I know that you see people in the supermarket and you say, oh, hey, I haven't seen you in years. So we can keep up with the idea of all these people, but there's this thing that was teased out of the literature by sociologist Robin Dunbar, and you'll hear a lot more about this person in the future because he's big in academia right now, big in psychology and sociology, but I think you're going to hear more and more as his new studies come out. He's identified this thing called Dunbar's number, and that is 150. And What that means is you can only really keep up with about 150 people any given time. Now, when I say keep up with, what I mean is you're keeping up with the soap opera. You're keeping up with, hey, this is what this person got for Christmas this year. Hey, I remember when this guy helped me out. This is she just had a new baby. Who has a beef with whom? Who is nice? Who's mean? What's your favorite color?
Right, I'd have a hard time keeping up with 150 of them. But
right, and that's actually where your brain cries uncle. Most people have a lot fewer than that. And it's because of this thing called social grooming, and all primates engage in it. It's called social grooming, and if you're an ape, or maybe you're one of my relatives, you sit down and you groom the hair of the person next to you, and you pick out the parasites, and you actually physically groom one another. Well, human beings still do that. We do it in Super Bowl parties, or we have a drink after work, or we share photographs, or we just talk on the phone, just hang out. That's social grooming too, and you have to engage in social grooming if you want to maintain a relationship. You can't just let someone fade into the background because you'll lose touch with them. I've had that happen to me at work many times, where someone who I engage with on a daily basis, they move away, and we say, oh, we'll keep up with each other, and they end up just becoming a floater on social media. And before social media, that person would just fade away completely. So he's identified that not only do we only keep up, can we only keep up with about 150 at max, and it can be a little bit more for some people, a little bit less, but we can see that our social institutions throughout the years have maxed out around the same size, and if they didn't, they started to break down. So you can see military units or tribes or divisions of companies, they all max out around 150. When he applied his research to social media, he noticed that people who have thousands of friends on Facebook, they still only engage in a routine basis with about 150 people max. And then even past that, most people really only have a circle of about 20 people. About 20 people you can, I think I say in the book, is something like you will share a funny video with thousands of people, but you will only share a secret with about 20.
Yeah, and do we have those thousands of friends just to make us feel popular?
I think it may be, and this is just my guess. I think it's sort of just it's social jewelry. It makes you feel like you have a high status, and it makes other people believe that you have, at least you think it makes other people think you have a high status, and it plays back into that story of your life that I was talking about earlier. It makes for a more interesting character, you, and it makes for a more interesting story that you can tell yourself.
Donna in Burlington is with us. Good morning, Donna.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment or ask a question about something you brought up about 5 minutes ago when you talk about how we think we're rational we think we're rational people, and we are our greatest heroine in our own movie, and everything's more like a true-to-life-based movie. And the way you make it sound like people really think way too highly of themselves and that they're too smart. So what do you have to say then to people who are on the opposite end of the spectrum, who feel more depressed or who are very overly self-critical?
The weird finding in psychology on this issue is that the people who are more self-deluded, but not to a fault, just enough, just the right sweet spot of self-delusion, are going to be more effective than people who are on the other side of that spectrum. So the people who are brutally honest with themselves tend to be more depressed, less effective, because they're less likely to do that thing where you just jump in the ocean and have to swim back to shore, sink or swim.
So our brains are trying to protect us in some cases.
A lot of the self-delusion, I talk about a lot of things just about reasoning and observing the world, but when it comes to the self-delusions of our persona, of our self-esteem, this has stuck with us for millions of years because it makes us effective people. Falsely believing that we can, that we're better than we are, or believing in our, amping up our abilities beyond the actual state that they're in, has allowed for us to engage in a behavior that gives us self-effectiveness that otherwise we might not even attempt.
You know, it was funny, David, when I was reading from the book this morning, I'm going to read a little bit of it because it was so funny. This sort of thinking also spreads to the way you compare yourself to others. The last 30 years' worth of research shows just about all of us think we are more competent than our coworkers, more ethical than our friends, friendlier than the general public, more intelligent than our peers, more attractive than the average person, less prejudiced than people in our region, younger looking than people our age, better drivers than most we know, better children than our siblings. And it goes on. I was just laughing as I was reading this long list because I do think I know people like this, but I was saying to myself, I'm not sure I think that about myself. And then you go on to write, as you read that list, maybe you said to yourself, no, I don't think I'm better than everyone. So you think you're more honest with yourself than the average person? You are not so smart.
Right.
It's hilarious.
I love it. I'm a Southerner, and we really highly value as a culture in this region, and I think this is probably true for your region too, humility. Mm-hmm. We expect people to be extra humble. We know if someone wins a Nobel Prize, we expect them to still drive a pickup truck and never mention it in conversation. So I'm fascinated by the idea that although there are different cultural standards, that when you put people in a lab or you put people in front of a questionnaire and you ask them to rate themselves on any scale, including all the ones that I mentioned in the book, every single one of those that you mentioned came out of a study where people were asked these questions. No one rates themselves as average. No one people tend not to rate themselves on average and tend not to rate themselves below average. I forget who said it, but there was one of my favorite quotes somewhere in the book is, the average person thinks they aren't. And that's because it's to be an effective person, you have to believe that you are a little bit, you've got a couple percentage points better than most people. And there's actually a consistent, predictable bias in psychology called self-serving bias, where when you give people the opportunity, they will attribute their successes, or whenever they complete something, whenever they do something well, they will attribute their success to themselves. But if they fail or they make a low grade on something, they will try to attribute the failure to forces that they couldn't control or outside sources. The self-serving bias plays into all manner of other things that grow out of that, and that's just the idea that you are extra super special, or at least better than average.
And getting back to Donna's point, if for some reason you're low on this scale of the self-serving bias, you're brutally honest with yourself, that's when you feel more depressed than someone else.
Yeah, and for most people, that won't last very long. Like we all go through these swings where we get knocked down by a lot. We get punched in the stomach by life. I know I've had this happen to me many times, and you mope for a while, but you start to use all the techniques that we've developed over our evolution to look on the bright side, to find ways that you feel that you are effective, that you can get better, and it's a good thing. Whenever you experience cognitive dissonance related to your own effectiveness as a human being, the best tactic is to salve that over, not with soothing words, but through actions, because the research says that you can't think your way to right actions. You must act your way to right thinking, and that's the only way to get past the stuff.
Yeah. The self-serving bias is also the explanation as to why people who cannot sing worth a darn end up on American Idol auditioning.
Yeah, that's more the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Okay.
Which is they're similar. All these things share DNA with each other. The Dunning-Kruger effect is the people who are least skilled are often the people who are also least aware that they are the least skilled. So, and it's just pretty simple. If you go from novice to amateur, that's a pretty fast process. You pick up a guitar and you have no idea how this thing works, and somebody teaches you a few chords and now you're playing a song. You might be inclined to think, and then in the lab, this is what people tend to do. You tend to believe, okay, this is really not that hard. I can't believe I thought the guitar was so hard. Oh man, this is actually simple. Just a few more months of this, and I'll be playing, as well as the virtuosos I've seen in concert. And then that's the Dunning-Kruger effect. Now, what's great about the Dunning-Kruger effect is if you push forward, it will diminish. As you attempt mastery, people realize how difficult it is to become a master, and that mastery may be impossible. But a weird thing that's happening in our culture, and this may have been going on for decades, but it's on TV now, is that there are a lot of people who are still in that early stage of going from, they've just arrived at amateur, and they start to falsely believe that they're very close to being a master, and that is something that we've been putting on TV for a while and pointing at and making fun of.
Let's take a call now from Victor in Milwaukee. Hello, Victor.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning to your guest. I think what we forget to keep in mind is sometimes your smartness is a matter of survival. Case in point, say like if there's like all the power in society was shut off or we lost some of our conveniences. Now, some people will make a remark, all right, for instance, that dumb Marine, he doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know this and that, but he's been trained on how to survive out in the wilderness where he's at, you know, to making the most out of the least. He knows how to read maps and everything. Then you look at that person as the smartest person on earth. Another point is a language barrier. Say, like, you're an American traveling overseas, maybe to a shanty town in South Africa, and you'll feel like a babe in the woods because that's not your environment. You're dealing maybe possibly with a language barrier. Same thing if a foreigner comes over here, we would think he or she is dumb.
Yeah.
Well, they're not.
So, yeah, your level of smartness, David, depends on the situation you're in.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I don't. I'm not saying when I say you are not so smart, I'm talking about self delusion, and I'm trying to. And I know some people are that puts them off immediately as I'm talking about raw intelligence, but psychology no longer looks at intelligence as being one scale. Intelligence is a many-headed beast. There are many types of intelligence. And even within just what we used to consider straight-up intelligence and knowledge, there's crystal intelligence and there's fluid intelligence where can you problem-solve well or do you have enough facts in your head to win at Jeopardy? I'm one of those people, and I try to say in the book, let's all agree that I think that we're all in this together. The same delusions that I'm talking about here are the same delusions that Einstein walked around with in his life. And there's a great Stephen Jay Gould quote that says, this is what your caller is talking about, and he said, I am somehow less interested in the weight and convolutions of Einstein's brain than in the near certainty that people of equal talent have lived and died in cotton fields and sweatshops. So sometimes just because people have climbed the ladder of celebrity through their amazing skills and intelligence, doesn't necessarily mean that they're superior to their peers. I think we're all in this together, and not only do we have the same promise with the same potential, but we also have the same stumbling blocks, and I'm just writing about those stumbling blocks.
Victor, thank you very much. Victor is one of the smartest people I know. David, what is the... But when you talked about the Marine and his survival skills, that reminded me of another example from the book on how our brains sometimes in an emergency just shut down and we don't... we think if we don't think about it, everything's going to be okay.
Yeah, that is such a strange thing, and it was something I had never heard about until I started researching for. I wanted to make sure that the book had plenty of stuff in it that wasn't on the blog, and that this is one of the things that is new to the book, and it's called normalcy bias, and it's another one of those cognitive biases that first responders and emergency workers, they are familiar with, but the general public is not. And this isn't freezing when like if you get a gun pulled on you or you are about to have a car wreck. This isn't that sort of freezing, where that's called fear bradycardia, but that's many animals do that. Mm-hmm. This is something else. This is begging for the world to return to normal by engaging in acts of normalcy, which I know that sounds weird, but let's imagine a flood, a tornado, a sinking ship, a burning building, anything like that. You think, you've seen all these movies, that somebody's going to jump up and go, let's get out of here, and and everybody runs
right
outside. But what usually happens is that people will stand around and wait. When something scary or life-threatening happens, people first want to believe that things are not scary or life-threatening and attempt to convince themselves everything is okay by going through a predictable series of reactions. And that series is, it starts with you engage in some of your normal routines, and then you gather information from the people who are next to you, if you still feel that maybe things are out of whack, you'll start contacting the people who you have relationships with, friends and family, and you just go through this routine over and over again until finally you reach the point where you're like, I really need to get out of here. And in the lab, they can get people to do this. This is one of the craziest studies. They have let's say they have five people in a room, and four of them are actors, and one of them is the actual subject of the study. They have them fill out a questionnaire, and the researcher walks out of the room. Then they start to fill the room up with smoke. It comes through the grate in the wall, and the actors have been told, don't draw any attention to it, and if somebody asks a question, don't say, hey, we're supposed to finish the test, let's just do it. So that's what they do. Everybody sits there, and
smoke is billowing into the room, and everybody's just sitting there as though everything's normal?
Right, and you would think that you imagine that if you're in this situation, you'd be like, oh, man, these guys are stupid, I'm going to get out of here, and you run away. But in the study, if all the actors act like everything is normal, the person will just sit there until the room is so full they can't even see their questionnaire. And, you know, in a real life or death situation, that person would die in a fire. And sometimes, it doesn't happen every time, but it is pretty consistent that if everyone is wondering, hey, is everything okay? Is this normal? I don't want to look stupid and be the first person to run out of here. And everybody's looking at each other and everyone thinks no one is freaking out. People will just sit around while the building burns.
Oh, that's scary. Peter in Kenosha is with us. Hello, Peter.
Hi. Great topic. I love this topic. And I remember from college being excited about this topic and bringing it up with my friends, and nobody will believe me. So I remember an experiment we did in the classroom where the professor had us all close our eyes, and we had to visualize the front of the room, for instance. I think it was the front of the room with the clock and the desk in front. And we had to come up with a mental representation of that. And then for about a minute we would do that, and then we would open our eyes and compare it to the reality. And you could see just these huge gaps in what we were visualizing. Though we were all familiar with that room, we'd been there all semester, the gaps were huge. And I do that with my friends all the time when they're skeptical about this. I'll have them just close their eyes and visualize a wall in my house, for instance, and compare it, and it works because everything's off scale. You forget pictures that are on the wall and stuff like that. So I'll take my
Is that similar, David, to that the eyewitness problems that we have?
That immediately pops up two things I'm thinking from the book, both the chapter on attention and the chapter on the misinformation effect. The reason I started, and I know that why that is why your caller is pointing that out, because I remember thinking the same thing whenever we did something similar in one of my classes and seeing it on YouTube and things later on. That was one of the things that inspired me to even start this project was two things. One's called inattentional blindness and one's called change blindness. In inattentional blindness, that's where you believe that your eyes are just cameras that are recording every single thing that's going on in front of you. But the truth is, you are—you really have a very narrow field of focus, and for the rest of it, you just fill in the gaps with almost dreamlike interpretations, just generalities about what's happening. In the lab, they will have people pass a basketball back and forth to each other, and it's in a video, and they ask the subject to count how many times the people have are passing the basketball, and at the end of the video, they will tally it up and say, okay, did you get this correct? It was 13 passes. And then the person goes, yay, I got it right. And then they say, did you notice the gorilla that walked through the video? And in the video, when you play it back, a guy in a gorilla suit walks through the video and waves at the camera and then walks out. And if you're not counting the passes, you see it.
I saw that video, and I did not see the gorilla the first time. I was counting the passes. So I'm trying to. So my brain in the counting aspect shut off that visual.
Right. It's not so much that it shut it off, it's that at all times you're doing that. At all times throughout the day, while you're awake, you're paying attention to a very narrow strip of reality. And the rest you're just letting fade into the background and is not being recorded. But our intuitive sense of it, what we believe is happening, and when we look back on our memories, what we think happened the entire time is that we paid attention to 100% of what was going on around us, when really we don't do that. And the other thing is change blindness, which is, man, I love this so much. They do a study where you do one study, and it's a fake study. And then at the end of it, the real study is you're supposed to turn in your answers to a person who's sitting behind a desk. And when you turn your answers in, the person behind the desk will duck down behind the desk as if they're pulling out the release form that you get your extra points for class for. And the person who stands up and hands you that form is a completely different person. And most people, or a good percentage of people, they don't realize that the person has completely changed right in front of their eyes.
That's amazing. We are going to take a short pause, and then we'll get to more of your calls for David McRaney. He is the author of You Are Not So Smart, Why You Have Too Many Friends on Facebook, Why Your Memory is Mostly Fiction, and 46 Other Ways You're Deluding Yourself. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. And after 9, former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm will join Kathleen to discuss her time as governor and her ideas for America's future. That's coming up. We are talking about ways our brains assist in deluding ourselves, talking about how our memory is mostly fiction, our brain resists new ideas, and welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, David McRaney, who is a journalist and author of You Are Not So Smart. And Hugh is with us next in Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. I think one thing should be mentioned, and that is that I think during important events in our lives, stressful events, we do remember. The memories are imprinted upon us, and I'll admit, eyewitnesses in crimes may be wrong here and there, but you know, I've had to use my memory. I'll give one example. Reverend Shuttlesworth from Birmingham died about a month ago, and I thought that I had heard him speak at Tulane Liberals Club in New Orleans many, many years ago. I won't go through the whole thing, but this led to a series of protests in New Orleans. Now, it turned out that talking to the others who involved, they said it wasn't Reverend Shuttlesworth. It was Aaron Henry, who was a black leader from Mississippi. I was wrong on that, but I was not wrong on the series of protests that led at a pizzeria and other things around.
Mm-hmm.
There was 50 years ago, there was the New Orleans Picayune did an article on the first sit-ins in New Orleans, and there was a picture of me. And I was kind of shocked when I saw it because I wasn't wearing my glasses. And then I realized that at the time, we were worried about being beaten up, and to wear glasses might endanger my eyes. So I didn't wear the glasses at the time. I've been interviewed by the FBI, particularly a few days.
You gave us a couple of examples here, and I want to get a reaction from our guest, David McRaney. What's going on with Hugh here? He says his memory got some faults, but he certainly remembers these important times in his life.
Sure, those things happen to Hugh, but as we're hearing, the details are getting less and less reliable as time goes by, and that's because memory is not—it's not a file that's stored in a computer. It's not a—it's not something that there's not a object in your mind in your brain that's called a memory. Memories are—they're not retrieved. Memories are created. Each time you remember something, it's new. It's more like Lego blocks, is what I try to tell people. It's just like a memory is like building a Lego toy. And then when you're done thinking about it, you disassemble it back into its Lego bricks and you throw them back in the box. And then the next time you want to remember that thing, you have to pull out those bricks and build it again. And each time you build it, it's being built in the context of what you know now, what you think now, what you feel now. And it's never a one-to-one representation of what happened. It changes over time. And they're very malleable. They're very easy to shift and change. Elizabeth Loftus has been doing research into this for almost her entire career, and she is concerned and trying to get rid of the institution of eyewitness accounts, because eyewitness accounts in the lab never hold up. What people believe they saw is never what they truly saw, and depending on how they're asked about it, how they will perceive it will change. Her great example is, and she was doing this to show how eyewitness accounts are so faulty, she showed an automobile accident, two cars, and they showed it to a group of people who were witnesses. There were subjects in this study. And she asked them to watch the video and then come in and for questioning. And in the questioning, she asked, how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other, for some people? For other people, she asked, how fast were the cars going when they bumped into each other? And for some people, she would say, like, how fast were they going when they contacted each other? Well, when people wrote down, and people were very confident in their memories, they didn't say, I'm not sure. When they estimated how fast the cars were going, if the stronger the language you use, the faster the cars were going. So if they were smashed, they were going somewhere like 40 miles an hour. But if they just contacted, they were only going 30. And she showed that, you know, if we're going to use eyewitness testimony to determine whether or not people go to jail or life, or if they're going to live or die, we're really not serving ourselves. And it's another example of how policy rarely pays attention to science. It goes with its gut feelings and its intuitions, and those things are not reliable.
Why is it, though, that we will remember, or at least we think we do, exactly what we were doing and how we were feeling when we learned the news of 9/11, or you know, when JFK was shot, or what, you know, some traumatic event like that?
Well, those are called flashbulb memories, and sometimes a flashbulb memory usually happens in a state of really high, they call it arousal in psychology. It just means a very high emotional state, and it's almost as if if you've ever had a camera that you can switch to, it takes 30 pictures a second instead of one picture. When you are really highly aroused, you will start taking many, 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 many more pictures. You will start recording more memories. And it's not that you are recording more memories or laying down more impressions. It's that you are not ignoring as much as you were before. And that flashbulb memory is something when it gets constructed anew, it's a far more reliable account of what happened, and it's something that sticks with you. It comes back to you because you're remembering all the things that you're putting down impressions of everything that happened around a significant event in your life. And an odd thing about flashbulb memories is sometimes they will just explode. You'll sometimes have a flashbulb memory for something that doesn't you don't even understand why is that something I remember so vividly. But in general, memory is very unreliable. I've been at parties before where I've been telling a story, and I'm like, and then I did this, and then I did that, and somebody says, "No, that wasn't you. That was me."
And I never remember the punchline to jokes. What's going on there? No. We have some other callers. Let's go to Fred in Palmyra. Hi, Fred.
Hey, good morning.
Morning,
Joy. You got to be one of my 20 people that the guest described earlier in the program.
What's that? What do you mean, Fred?
I can't think of 20 friends that I have. But our son was on the computer one day, and he announced that a girl he knows at school has 852 friends on Facebook, and he said, "I don't even know 800 people."
Yeah. You know? Well, we're glad that you're a listener, Fred, and I'm glad you consider me a friend. But so you're just saying that you don't have too many friends on Facebook?
Well, no, I don't go on Facebook myself. No, I don't use a computer except to look at an email once in a while. But when your guest was talking earlier about people and how this self-delusion and deluding themselves, and I wondered if, you know, what he said about the people who are too self-critical are less effective. And I've always been critical of myself. I set pretty high standards. And I find that at one time when I was younger, I probably tended to be more self-delusional about my capabilities, and then as I got older and got more honest, discovered that I've been wrong about so many darn things. How about as people age? Maybe he can talk about that.
Yeah, good. Well, good question, Fred. He doesn't think he's deluding himself anymore, David.
Yeah, you know, I mean, these are. I think while processing, all of us are going to continue to self-delude. But when we start, but wisdom itself is really true. Wisdom is recognizing failure, recognizing how many times we've been incorrect, recognizing how many times we have messed up, done the wrong thing, and true wisdom is going back over something and knowing how you're more likely to mess up in the future. It's having a clear understanding of your failings so that whenever you come back to a situation, you won't fail the same way again. And I think with age, that definitely comes. As I get older, younger people tend to get dumber to me.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing thing because I remember being their age and thinking that I was that not dumb and that I was not inexperienced, and the people younger than me were. And it makes me think that probably right now there are people older than me thinking the same thing, and they're probably right. So, yes, with age comes wisdom, no doubt in that. But we have to remember that I believe, and I think this is what you can get from what I write, that real wisdom comes from whenever you go, oh, okay, I am guilty of doing that. And, you know, humility generates wisdom, and I'm trying to sort of do this this book as a shock and awe campaign to make you feel more connected with the community of man through our shared failings.
Yeah. Well, one of my shared failings with many, and it happens time and time again, even though I'm much older now, is I procrastinate. And I've been meaning to talk to you about this. I'm not alone. Our brains do this to us.
Wow, you're not alone. I'm the worst. And I think I wrote this this chapter just to explain to myself, why do you keep doing this? I like many people, I thought procrastination was just laziness. But the research says that procrastination is really just a failure to have an adequate strategy to deal with your future self. So it's something in psychology called present bias, and that is you believe that the way you feel now is going to be the way you feel later. And we probably all experience this every day when we say, when I get off work today, I'm going to go work out, and then I'm going to write this essay, and then I'm going to work in the yard, and then I'm going to do this. And then you get home from work and go, I'm just going to lay off the guy. And it's because there are two yous in that day. There's the you right now, and there's the you that's going to be coming home from work. And in the present, you believe that later person is going to have the exact same emotional state, the same desires as you have now. They do it in the lab all the time. They give people an option in the future to do something like eat a cupcake or eat a salad. And they say, okay, I'm going to give you this choice tomorrow, and what are you going to pick? And they say, well, I'm going to pick the salad. And then in the moment, more people switch over to the cupcake because they can't accurately predict their future self.
Oh, they were deluding themselves with that one. We only have about a minute to go. Okay. Is there something we can do today that will help us, take into account that we are not so smart?
I would recommend that you every once in a while you do this. You do a 360 in your life, and you truly imagine where you are right now. Don't trust the opinions of other people, your friends. They love you. They're not going to check you. You're going to have to check yourself. And I would hope that whenever you look at the research that I'm putting out there, that you go off and do your own research and see that there's just so much coming out of science right now that's telling us that we're not rational, logical, predictable, and that we're not rational, logical beings who are only looking out for our best interest in a mathematical, robotic way. We're deeply emotional, we're deeply flawed, we're deeply human, and it's a good thing, but we have to be honest with ourselves about that, and I think once you're honest with yourself, you can really find ways to improve.
Thank you very much for being with us. I feel a little smarter already. David McRaney, journalist, author of You Are Not So Smart, Why You Have Too Many Friends on Facebook, Why Your Memory is Mostly Fiction, and 46 Other Ways You're Deluding Yourself. He blogs at youarenotsosmart.com. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for producing this hour, and to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for on-air production and direction as well. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.